We continue now with part two of World Religions and Extraterrestrial Contact, originally presented on August 13th, 2022.
So let's now move to some of the other religious traditions. Egypt's pyramid texts. So the Inead, one of the pyramid texts, talk about the Aeneid, the nine principal creator gods. Atum, or Atum Ra, Ra meaning the sun god. So Atum Ra is the self-created sun god. So this is a being that emerges out of the primordial void, fully emancipated, all-powerful, well, not quite all-powerful, but he emerges out of the potentiality of the primordial void waters that are disseminating this love light energy, because that's what they are. That's what the Law of One teaches us. So this creator god, Atum, emerges out of that. So then he creates successor gods, his children, Shu and Tefnut, followed by Geb and Nut, followed by Osiris, Isis, Set and Nephthys. So these are the original creator gods of the Egyptian pantheon. So they are the creator gods. They are the ones from which all the other gods then follow. So this follows pretty much the same trajectory as I described for the Enuma Elish. You know, you have Apsu, Kingu, then you have Anu and Enlil, Enki, and so forth. So immediately there is, again, patricidal or fratricidal conflict between the gods. So in this case, Set murders his brother, Osiris. And so the council of the gods intervenes. So the fratricidal conflict erupts when Set, god of the desert, kills Osiris, who is the pharaoh of Egypt. And at the time, Egypt was really the city of Memphis. So Egypt was the city of Memphis, which was the kind of known civilization at the time, and Osiris was the ruler of the city, whereas Set was the ruler of the desert. So Set was jealous of his brother Osiris and murders him. And so then the council of the gods, led by Ra or Atum, creates a set of trials between Horus, the son of Osiris, and Set for who would rule Egypt. So there's a set of trials where Set and Horus battle against each other to determine who would rule. So it wasn't just a matter of Set kills Osiris, the king or the pharaoh of Egypt, and he becomes the new pharaoh. No, it doesn't work that way. He does kill him, but the succession is determined by the council of the gods, who say, okay, in order to determine who is going to be the new ruler of Egypt, we're going to set these trials, and we are going to adjudicate, or we're going to set up an adjudication board to determine who is going to be the rightful successor to Osiris. So the Council of Gods appoints this court to adjudicate the successor trials. So the court comprises Ra, the first creator god, Thoth, the god of wisdom, and Shu, the air god, to determine who's going to win this trial to determine the new ruler of Egypt, of Memphis, or the city. And so eventually this battle between Set and Horus results in both committing things that the whole council of gods finds odious, that they are not happy with either one. And so eventually what happens is that the council consults the spirit of Osiris and says, well, you know, Set did some terrible things and Horus has also done things that we find odious, so who should be your successor? And Osiris says Horus should be the successor. So the Council of Gods appoints Horus the successor. So the Egyptian gods and extraterrestrials. So what we are viewing here is not a mythical spiritual battles that took place in the imagination of ancient peoples, primitive peoples. These were real life space wars involving humans with advanced technologies and secret space programs and extraterrestrials who were the sponsors of these different human factions and used the human factions as proxies in their wars. And what we have here, again, is this idea of these battles between the different gods refers to one extraterrestrial faction fighting against another in terms of whose genetic experiment would be the dominant one, whose genetics would be allowed to spread, and whose genetics would be curtailed or decimated because of another faction's successes on the war field. So I think this is what these mythological texts are referring to, that these were real-life battles between extraterrestrials sponsoring different human kingdoms who were the offshoots of these genetic experiments, and they were all battling for supremacy to see whose bloodline, whose genetics would spread and whose would kind of contract. Now, the Egyptian gods and the extraterrestrials, the trials that were set by the assembly of the nine gods, that refers to a galactic council that would adjudicate disputes. This is where the idea of the Council of Saturn comes in. Now, one of the things that I found when I was working closely with Corey Good and his secret space program information was he talked about this meeting place, this diplomatic meeting place in the region near Saturn, and that they would discuss humanity's future. And he talked about this this super federation. Now, I think the super federation is what others describe as the Council of Saturn. It was the one that determined or made decisions concerning disputes between the different extraterrestrial factions over what was happening on Earth. Who was breaking the rules? Who was acting in alignment with the kind of rules or the mandates of the council that had been set upon in time immemorial? So in other words, you know, what we're talking about in terms of the interaction between different extraterrestrials that have these genetic experiments occurring all over the Earth, and that there are conflicts between these different groups in terms of their proxies, their human proxies expanding and coming into conflict with one another, is that essentially there would be this Saturnian council, and that in turn would answer to higher bodies. And they would make the decisions as to whether or not it would be okay for the Huns to sweep into Europe and decimate European civilization, whether it would be all right for the colonial powers to sweep into South America and exterminate the indigenous peoples there. That it wasn't just a matter of the Spanish Empire or Genghis Khan or Julius Caesar making these decisions, you know, by making prayers to Ares, the god of war, or whoever the god was. There were deliberations by these different extraterrestrial councils that said, oh, okay, well, we'll allow Julius Caesar to do this because Julius Caesar is spreading these genetics that we want to be spread through the British Isles. That Genghis Khan, he is spreading genetics from Asia Minor into Europe or into China that we want spread, and so forth. That was what was going on. That these battles, these wars, are not just accidents. That there's a plan, there's a mystery behind that, and that the assembly of the gods or the Council of Saturn or the Super Federation were the ones permitting a lot of this to happen. So this is where we get back to the idea of monotheism, and we have Akhenaten. So monotheism, in Egypt. Just as monotheism was a kind of late development in the Sumerian and the Hebrew tradition, similarly, in the Egyptian, it was a late development. After a long period of worship of the gods, the confederation of planets shows up and says, you know, you humans, you're worshipping these gods, but, you know, they're not all that different to you. There is this primordial creator god that is truly unknown, and this creator god emanates love light. And if you learn how to connect with that being, you will be good channels for this love light energy, and that is what we see as really essential for the development or the evolution of humanity. And I suspect that the law of one was permitted by this council of gods, that they saw the efficacy of doing this, that the confederation of planets were able to persuade this super federation or the council of Saturn and say, the way the human experiments are being managed by the 24 civilizations is very wasteful. We think that the humans would benefit from developing this monotheistic tradition. And so that's how monotheism began to emerge, through these early pioneers that talked about this all creator God that isn't identified with any one of the Elohim or the creator gods, but this kind of primordial source energy of love light. So this is where the Law of One talks about Akhenaten. The one known as Akhenaten, for a time moved, shall we say, heaven and earth in order to invoke the Law of One and to order the priesthood of these structures in accordance with the distortions of an initiation and true compassionate healing. This was not to be long-lasting. So the emphasis was on true compassionate healing, love light, that this is what the Law of One is focused on, the power of forgiveness, of love, of healing. This is what can be traced to that primordial creator energy, if you like, the all-infinite one, rather to any one of the creator gods. So that's the Law of One, material 23.6. So Akhenaten, Moses, and monotheism. So there have been a number of scholars that have looked at this relationship between Moses and Akhenaten and believe that Moses was in fact Akhenaten and that he was spreading this Law of One or this belief in monotheism in a society that was steeped in traditional worship in the creator gods. So Akhenaten is Moses, and he flees Egypt due to the polytheistic priests rejecting his monotheistic belief system. So, of course, Akhenaten, or Moses, believed in this idea of the one infinite creator disseminating love light, and that the highest path to be followed is to be a channel for that love light energy, thereby preaching love, forgiveness, kindness, healing. That is the pure expression of the love light energy from the one infinite creator. Whereas the creator gods from the different traditions are all about power, control, competition. So Akhenaten flees Egypt with this monotheistic belief system. So Moses exported that Law of One philosophy as taught by Akhenaten. And it's important to emphasize here that the Law of One material points out that Akhenaten was teaching the Law of One. No ambiguity there. Akhenaten was teaching that. So if Akhenaten is Moses, then it follows that Moses took with him the Law of One philosophy, which is consistent with what I said earlier about Abraham exporting the Law of One philosophy out of Sumer. So this is where the traditional religion known as Judaism emerges. And so within Judaism, you have this, as I mentioned already, you have this conflict, if you like. On the one hand, you have this, the law of one philosophy as taught by the patriarchs, some of the patriarchs, which is all about love, forgiveness. And on the other hand, you have this tribal, genocidal belief in this all-powerful creator God, Yahweh, that commands the early Israelites to exterminate other peoples. Clearly nothing to do with this kind of love light energy that is associated with the law of one. But nevertheless, if you interpret monotheism, and monotheism can be interpreted in either way, you can interpret it in terms of this, the one infinite creator of all, so the creator of the creator gods is this one infinite creator, which is this emanation of love light energy, or it can be interpreted as this all-powerful chief god like Yahweh. This is where you have a tension within the Hebrew tradition, and I will talk about how that reemerges in Christianity. So then we have the Vedic tradition, the Vedic trinity of gods. So you have Vishnu, the preserver, you have Brahma, the creator, and you have Shiva, the destroyer. So they sit at the apex of the Hindu pantheon that creates, preserves, and destroys the universe in vast cycles of time. So they describe the universe in terms of, again, this kind of primordial waters, this kind of the primordial milk. They just, in Vedic texts, they describe it as a milk, but it's the same thing, the primordial waters out of which all creation emerges. So the Vedic creation story, there was no heaven, earth, or space in between. The world was a large, dark, vast ocean that licked the edges of night. In the ocean, a giant cobra floats asleep in the water. In the endless coils of the cobra is Lord Vishnu. Vishnu watches over the serpent. Everything is peaceful, silent. From the depths of the sea, Vishnu begins to hear the noise, which awakens him. As the dawn begins to break, a lotus opens, releasing Vishnu and the serpent. Brahma, Vishnu commands the snake, it's time to start, create the world. So again, you have this idea of this primordial ocean out of which the creator gods, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, emerge forward, fully empowered, and then they create the pantheon of Vedic gods. So the Vedic creation story out of which creation begins, mirrors other religious traditions that point to oceans, ocean-dwelling civilizations, as the genesis of life. I think you can make the point here that all of this suggests that it was the oceans that is where the first intelligent life forms emerged. So the Vedic creation story, so there are these cycles, these enormous cycles of time that refer to the birth, life, and death of ancient civilizations and, of course, historical epochs where these different gods, Shiva, Brahma, and Vishnu, play key roles in different phases of that cycle, birth, life, and death. So these ancient civilizations, they are born, they last for a time, and then they die. And the remnants of those civilizations then start a new genetic experiment. And so the Vedic Indians worship extraterrestrials as gods. So this was something that the humans understood that were created as a result of genetic experiments. They worshipped their creators as gods, these extraterrestrials that were creating humans in these genetic experiments. They were worshipped in this way. The Vedic gods interbreed with humanity. So the Vedic gods, they commingle with humans, just as the Bible and the Sumerian texts talk about the intermingling of the gods of the Elohim with humans. So too, you have the Vedic gods intermingling with humans, and the interbreeding refers to genetic experiments in Vedic India and the creation of Edens in Vedic India. Now, this is where, okay, you know, what are these Edens? Are we talking about laboratories on extraterrestrial motherships like the Nibiru that was run by Enki, and that this is where the first humans are created, or are we talking about particular locations on the Earth? It could be both. It could well be both. And that may be what was occurring throughout the world, that the genetic experiment would go from the research phase on a starship to the application phase where it's actually transported to the Earth and in a particular region, and that genetic experiment is allowed to flourish and see where it goes. So the Vedic gods create humans, they co-mingle with them and create genetically upgraded humans or hybrids that become the kings and the sages. So eventually the Vedic civilization collapses. And there are sources that describe nuclear attacks on Vedic India. So Vedic texts describe these nuclear attacks and radiation poisoning suffered by the victims of these attacks. So the destruction of Vedic civilizations coincided with Atlantis's global wars of conquest. So in terms of coming out with a timeline here, you can make the correspondence between the destruction of Vedic India through these nuclear attacks with these wars of conquest that Plato described, where Atlantis went on this campaign of global wars to assert dominance over all other peoples. And this was not allowed because, and I think the reason is simple, is that if we're talking about up to 24 different extraterrestrial genetic experiments, and these genetic experiments are allowed to kind of like expand or contract through different empires and so forth, and through the interaction, through the permission of these different councils, whether we're talking about a council of Saturn, a super federation, a sky council of the Elohim, or the Anunnaki, that at some point Vedic civilization was allowed to be destroyed because there needed to be a reset. So there was a contraction there, or a destruction. So now we get to the ancient Greeks. So where do the ancient Greeks fit into all of this? So Hesiod is known as the preserver of the ancient Greek oral traditions. He's the one who recorded most faithfully the oral traditions of the ancient Greeks and talked about the creation story of the Greeks. His Theogony is an epic poem that synthesizes the Greek creation story as recorded in multiple oral traditions. It's the first known Greek cosmogony. Uranus and Kronos. So again, you have this primordial couple. So you have the primordial waters out of which creation emerges. So out of the primordial waters, you have Uranus and Gaia. And once again, there's a little bit of kind of ambiguity over Gaia, the feminine aspect. Is Gaia representing the consort of Uranus, just as Tiamat was the consort of Apsu, or was Gaia the primordial waters out of which Uranus emerged, similarly to how Apsu emerged out of Tiamat? So there's a bit of ambiguity there. But nevertheless, you have the primordial couple, Uranus and Kronos. So they beget 18 children who Uranus imprisons because he fears that these 18 children will supplant him. So this is the idea, a very important idea, that the gods, the creative gods, have this fear within them that their children will one day supplant them. And so Uranus, because he He knew that there was this prophecy that he would be supplanted by his children, that he imprisoned his 18 children. Gaia was very upset by this, and so she plotted with the youngest of the Titans, Cronos, to overthrow Uranus. And so eventually there's a battle between Cronos and Uranus. So after castrating Uranus, Cronos becomes the supreme god, the new supreme god. So he marries Rhea, one of the other creator gods, and he then begets the Olympian gods who are imprisoned. Because again, there's this prophecy that the chief god, the chief creator god, will be supplanted by his children, by his offspring. So Rhea frees Zeus, who is one of the imprisoned Olympian gods, because Rhea is very sympathetic to her imprisoned children. Naturally, who wouldn't be? And Zeus forces Cronos to release the other Olympian gods. So everything is good for a while. So Cronos and the Titans rule Greece and the known world, and Zeus and the Olympian gods kind of watch. They're on the sidelines, but they're unhappy with the way things are conducted. So eventually, you guessed it, there's a war, another war. So Zeus and the Olympian gods go to war against Cronos and the Titans. And so Cronos and the Titans are imprisoned in Tartarus after their defeat, and Zeus becomes the victor, and he and the other Olympian gods, they form a sky council. They form a supreme council. So you then have the assembly of the Olympian gods. So all major Olympian gods reside at Mount Olympus, where they form an assembly. Zeus, Hera, Athena, Poseidon, Artemis, Apollo, Demeter, Hester, Aphrodite, Hermes, Hephaestus, and Ares. And Zeus breaks this prophecy or this legend that he would be one day supplanted by one of his children, by rather than allowing the children to be born through his partner, he actually devours his partner and then gives birth to Athena through his own forehead. And so that way he subverts, or he changes the prophecy. So he's not going to be supplanted by the successor gods, by his children. So that's the legend of the Olympian gods and their successors. So the key takeaway here is that Zeus rules in conjunction with an assembly of the gods. It's not just him being the one supreme absolute ruler. He rules through an assembly. He is like the chief god. He's the chairman of the board, if you like. But the humans worship Zeus and all the gods. So the gods interbreed with the humans. So gods and humans have liaisons with mortals from which heroes, sages, and rulers are born. Hercules, Aeneas, Achilles, the whole succession of Greek heroes or non-Greek heroes in the ancient Greek world are byproducts of these liaisons between the gods and humans. What this refers to is ongoing genetic experiments or interbreeding in some way with the humans. Homer's Iliad, that describes the roots of the Trojan War as an apple being thrown into the assembly of the gods for the most beautiful goddess. So Eros throws the golden apple into Olympus and says, for the most beautiful goddess. And that sets off a war, because Zeus is not going to adjudicate between his wife Hera, Aphrodite, the goddess of love, or Athena, the goddess of wisdom. And he says, well, you gods decide. So the gods are divided. And so they then battle it out through this proxy war involving the ancient Greeks and the humans. And so the giveaway here is that the assembly of the gods is the one determining human history. They make the decisions and they kind of manipulate humans in this proxy war. So that's Homer's Iliad describes this, and it's kind of almost like a lament. that humans are destined to play this role of just fighting out the gods' senseless wars against one another. So the Greek gods and extraterrestrials. So the successor gods, the successor conflicts between Uranus and Kronos, Kronos and Zeus, involve different extraterrestrial groups arriving and asserting authority over the Mediterranean region. So I think this is what we're talking about here, is that that area of the Mediterranean saw different extraterrestrial factions coming and going, each one starting their own genetic experiment, running across the genetic experiment of an earlier group of extraterrestrials, and the conflicts there represented one group of extraterrestrials fighting against another group using their proxies to fight it out, to determine who would be the victor. And that's represented in Homer's Iliad as well. So the Greek gods and extraterrestrials, the human children of the gods were extraterrestrial hybrids with an enhanced ability that dominated others. Heracles, son of Zeus, and Alcmena. Zeus, of course, the god, Alcmena, a human mortal. And you see this in the ancient Greek world, virgin births. This was the way the ancients described these gods interbreeding with humans to give birth to these great heroes or these sages, that these were liaisons between gods or extraterrestrials and humans. So these were genetic experiments. And the virgin births was a way in which these genetic hybrids would bring in a set of genetics into the human experiment, thereby change everything. Just as today, in our age, we have the grey extraterrestrials intervening, and they're doing a lot of virgin births. I mean, they're doing these genetic experiments where they take women up into the spacecraft, and they are introducing semen extracted from males into these women. And this, and the woman is taken back, and then miraculously, this woman is a virgin. Miraculously, she's born. Now, of course, today, many of these women are taken back, but in some cases, the women give birth, and it's an immaculate conception. It's a virgin birth. And the being that is born has these enhanced genetics. So they become heroes because they have superior intellect, superior psychic abilities, superior physical strength, whatever abilities that the extraterrestrials wanted the humans to have, to that would impact the genetic experiment in some way. So that's what these virgin births represent. That's what these comminglings of the extraterrestrials or the gods with humans represent. It's a way in which a new genetic strain can be introduced into the genetic experiment in a particular region that's ruled by a particular extraterrestrial faction, whereby the broader assembly of extraterrestrials, the galactic, whether you call it the Super Federation, whether you call it the Council of Saturn, gives approval to all this. So this is what's been going on for millennia. So the resolving the disputes over the ancient, over Greek Eden, the Olympian gods, again, a galactic council where ETs could resolve disputes over control and management over the different Edens. So Plato's account of Atlantis and its war with the ancient Greeks. So he describes Atlantis's advanced technology and its global aggression before its demise. The ancient Greeks successfully defend themselves against the Atlantean invaders. So the ancient Greeks were contemporaries of the Atlanteans, and they had also their own advanced technologies that they used to defend themselves against the Atlanteans. Now, there's some books that have recently come out through this regression therapist using Dolores Cannon's quantum healing, quantum hypnosis healing technique, QHHT, that describes a number of people having similar past life memories of being part of an extraterrestrial, or being part of Atlantis or Lemuria, and describing the origins of Atlantis as being a genetic experiment. So in this book by Sarah Brisman Cosmes, she talks about how Atlantis was seeded by extraterrestrials that brought these red crystals with great power. And what happened was that the crystals eventually were weaponized by the Atlanteans and ultimately led to their demise because they went on a rampage of war to try and control the world, and that was not something that was sanctioned by the Council of Saturn, as described by Plato. So Atlantis was contacted by the Confederation of Planets at some point, which also taught the Law of One. So Atlantis was created by these extraterrestrials, and it followed a similar pattern to Egypt and Sumeria. And the Atlanteans also were introduced to the idea of the Law of One. So this is the Law of One material, and it says, quote, the question from Don Elkins was, a large enough number of the entities of Atlantis had started at least going in the direction of the Law of One and living the Law of One for their call to be heard by the Confederation. The Confederation then used channels such as we use now for communication and also made contact directly. But this turned out to be a mistake because it was perverted by some of the entities of Atlantis. Is this correct? This is correct. So the Law of One, this philosophy in terms of belief in the one infinite creator that disseminates love light, and if you align yourself with this love light energy that emanates from the one infinite creator, then you are playing a very important role in transforming that society and in the genetic experiment. And the Confederation found that, well, once there were enough people practicing this Law of One philosophy, they physically intervened in Atlantis and began to disseminate the Law of One philosophy to more people, but eventually it was perverted. Just as I mentioned earlier, that there was a perversion of the Law of One philosophy by the Hebrews, where they began to distort it to believe in this all-powerful, to believe in this kind of genocidal Yahweh. So too in Atlantis, they followed, the same thing happened. Similarly, Lemuria was an ET genetic experiment. I did an interview with Jen Sullivan of her book, Child of the Universe, and she described her past life regression, where she describes being Lemuria and also being one of the seeders, that she was one of these extraterrestrials that actually seeded Lemuria and was a contemporary of an extraterrestrial that played a role in the seeding of Atlantis. And again, it's the use of these red crystals that was critical for the development and the expansion of those two civilizations. Well, I'm kind of like a little behind time. I have a few more slides. I'll probably go for another half hour in the presentation. But so let's go on. So now we go to the Papulva, I think is pronounced correctly, Papulva. Angelica's nodding her head, so yes, that's how you pronounce it. So that's the Mayan creation story. So this is what the Mayans say. All was immobility and silence. In the darkness, in the night, only the creator, the former, the dominator, the feathered serpent, those who engineer, those who give being, hovered over the waters as a dawning light. So there again, it's a description of the waters, the primordial waters out of which all life emerged, out of which the creator gods emerged, out of which the feathered serpent emerged, and out of which those who engineer emerged. So the Papulva describes the creation of humans. So let us try again. So you have this succession of gods being created by the creator gods, just as I've already described with the Sumerians and the Greeks. Now you have the Papulva, the Mayans, describing their creator gods. So quote, let us try again. Let us make those who will become our avatars and those who will bring our food. So the engineers determined to make of man, Of red earth, they molded his flesh. So they are talking about creating humans who would somehow produce things that would be of value to the gods, that would bring food to the gods. So what is that? So what is the food to the gods? Well, it's humanity's devotion. It's their fealty. The psychic energy you transmit to the gods is their louche, if you like. So this is what the gods or the extraterrestrials look to. They're looking, this is why they promote belief in themselves. So, for example, Yahweh, he was jealous of the other gods that was getting that were getting a lot of attention, a lot of loyalty, a lot of energy from the early Hebrews that believed in the Elohim, that believed in the council of the Elohim. So he believed, he promoted this belief in the one all-powerful God, Yahweh, so that all Hebrews would pray to him, so that would enhance his power. So this is, the Papulva is describing this process. So they create perfect humans. So now the engineers could look upon beings who were worthy of their origin. The four progenitors of the human race, strong and good-looking, they had clear sight and saw all things, great and small, on earth and in the heavens. And this echoes what I mentioned earlier about Enki genetically engineering humanity and finding that the genes of humanity were already carrying within them incredible potential because earlier guardians or earlier cedar races had already created or interceded and genetically upgraded humans, and humans had evolved over successive periods of catastrophes so that the primitive humans that the Sumerians or that the Anunnaki genetically upgraded were not primitive at all. They had this incredible potential. So the Papulva is making the very similar point here, that that the early humans had this incredible potential and that the engineers saw this. So the engineers are like Enki. Enki is like an engineer, geneticist. So the Mayan gods decided that they would dumb humans down because the humans were too powerful. They were frightened of the humans. But this did not please the engineers. What will we do with humans now? They have become like gods. They will want to make themselves equal to us. Let us therefore limit their sight. So they breathed a cloud over the pupil of the human's eyes, and their sight was darkened. So this, the Papulva is talking about this process whereby, as a result of the genetic experiments that the gods were running, and because there have been so many genetic experiments where different extraterrestrial groups would come in and create a genetic experiment over the top of an earlier genetic experiment, just as the Romans came in and built their great temples over the temples of earlier civilizations and different power spots all over the planet, same thing happening with these genetic experiments. And the extraterrestrial geneticists or engineers saw the incredible potential that humans had. Some geneticists, like Enki, saw this and they were thrilled. They thought, well, this is incredible. These humans have the potential to be something awesome, and they wanted to encourage that. Whereas other extraterrestrials looked at that and they said, no fucking way. We don't want these humans to be powerful like us. We're going to dumb them down. So that's what they did. They dumbed them down. They dumbed us down. Dumbing down of humans is a common motive in creation stories. So Paul Wallace describes it in Escaping from Eden. Stories of creator gods engineering perfect humans and then either dumbing humans down or afflicting them with disease, etc., to prevent humans from becoming godlike is found in multiple religious traditions. The Tower of Babel and extraterrestrial intervention is a good example of this. So in the Tower of Babel, in the book of Genesis, it says, quote, "The Lord Elohim came down to see the city and the tower which mortals had built. And the Lord Elohim," that's the actual correct Hebrew term. The word Lord does not appear in Hebrew text. It's just an interpolation by Christian or Hebrew scholars. There is no word Lord in the Hebrew. It's Elohim or Yahweh. Those are the two choices. So, "and the Lord Elohim said, look, They are one people, and they all have one language. And this is only the beginning of what they will do. Nothing they propose to do will now be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language there so that they will not understand one another's speech. So Paul Wallace is saying that the texts tell us that it is the technological ability being built into Babel that the Council of Powerful Ones, the Elohim, wishes to sabotage. They do not want to see human beings operating on that level. They do not want to be jostling up against a spacefaring human race. And so they resolve in council to shut down the entire civilization. So this shows that this idea that humans carry within our genetics, this incredible potential that frightens some of the genetic engineers of extraterrestrial groups that have been playing oversight of different Edens or different Earth civilizations, is pervasive, that they recognize within us this incredible potential. I know this is one of the things that Alex Collier, and I think he's watching, so shout out to Alex, he's been saying since the early 1990s, he said that the Patal, he describes the earliest guardians of the galaxy, of the known universe, the Patal, the ones that created the original Stargate or portal system throughout the galaxy, that they regarded us, or at least the Andromedans, the Andromedan Council, regards us as genetic royalty because we have all of these incredible extraterrestrial potentials within us. As each extraterrestrial group comes in and launches its genetic experiment and then supplants another group and builds its own genetic experiment, which then gets supplanted by another extraterrestrial faction, that is each one builds upon each other. It's not as though the genetics are completely wiped. The genetic seeds from the earlier genetic experiments are somewhere there in the DNA and preserved. And so Alex was saying that this was why the Andromedans regarded us as genetic royalty, because they, unlike many of the other extraterrestrial groups, had superior time travel technology, and they could see into the future where one day humanity would learn to utilize the full potential of our DNA and we would become the guardians of the galaxy. Simple as that. Or the masters, if you like. And we would literally supplant the gods. And, you know, this idea that you humans, the creators, or so the creations of the gods, which will originally, which would eventually supplant the gods, is part of the fear of the gods, is part of the traditions. As I mentioned, in Greek legend, Uranus was fearful of Cronus, of his children, because the prophecy was that he would be eventually supplanted by his creation. So that is something that repeats in other traditions. And we, as the creations of these extraterrestrial geneticists, we eventually will supplant them and we will become the guardians of the galaxy. We will have our own genetic experiments. And, you know, we're already beginning that now. So now we get to Jesus. So where does Jesus fit into all of this? Christianity, contemporary Christianity, where does that all fit into all of this? So to begin with, we need to understand Jesus as the anointed one, Jesus the Christ, because people think Christ is like Jesus Christ. It's like, you know, Michael Sala, Sala is my surname, or Angelica Wycliffe, Wycliffe is her surname. Christ is not a surname. Christ is a title. It comes from the Greek word Christos. It means the anointed one. And in the Hebrew tradition, it means the Messiah. Hebrew, the Mashiach. So I'm probably bungling that. Hebrew is non-existent. So Jesus, Saul, David, Solomon are all described in biblical texts as the anointed one. And so this idea of the anointed one is important to understand in terms of this being a sign of this person being favored by the gods. And here you have an image of Mary and Jesus. And Jesus, of course, is being cradled by an angel. The angel represents extraterrestrial. But you can see just above Mary's left shoulder there, you can see a spaceship. There's a connection there between Jesus and extraterrestrials. So what is that connection? I'll talk about that soon. Now, anointed ones, our contactees. Now, Cliff High, he did a presentation where he talks about the contamination process by which the decontamination process by which the anointed one undergoes. He describes the anointed one. That term really refers to the bacteriological decontamination process used by the Elohim for human contactees taken aboard their spacecraft. So many contactees describe being taken on board one of the extraterrestrial spacecraft and that they are anointed, that there are certain oils and lotions put all over them so that they smell nice. Well, Cliff High makes the point, a very good point, that that's a decontamination process. And because the extraterrestrials have very acute sense of smell, they didn't want these stinky, smelly humans, you know, working in the fields with cow dung and all of that, you know, coming into their pristine ships. So they just decontaminated them and all of that. And of course, when these anointed ones went back to Earth and described what had happened to them, yeah, you know, that's where the term came from, that to be anointed means to be decontaminated by the extraterrestrials.
When the Elohim dealt with humans, they couldn't deal with us directly because they were very susceptible to bacteria. And so we had to be, and fungus. And so we had to be, as humans, we had to be purified. And so there's all this stuff in all these religions where you deal with the space aliens. So we see the same things in Sumerian religions related to the Anunnaki, the Jewish religion, and we see the same thing in the Hindu religion where there's all this stuff about purification and cleansing and all of that. Well, it's all because we are, to the space aliens, we're potential danger because we carry so many bacteria and stuff that they are susceptible to. And so we've got to be anointed. We've got to be covered with very specific amounts of specific substances. So in the Bible, you see that the anointed people are covered in frankincense, myrrh, cloves, allspice, black seeds, black seed oil, all of these kind of things. And basically what they do is they strip you down naked and they scrub you, and then they just cover you with all of these antifungal, antibacterial oils that have a pleasant aroma. Apparently the El and the Anunnaki, the Elohim, the Devas in India, all of these gods, all these names for the gods, all of these people that were spoken of as gods were highly sensitive to smell. And so, they had smell receptors like a dog, in the sense that they could smell stuff that we would not even have a clue about.
It's quite simple. So Jesus and the Star of Bethlehem, what does that mean? What's the Star of Bethlehem? And was that an extraterrestrial contact event? Well, you have the star itself appearing suspiciously over the sky during the birth of Jesus over the town of Bethlehem, and it was the guiding light for these wise men to come to meet with Jesus. They followed the light. They just followed the light of the Star of Bethlehem. Well, how could a star shine a light on one particular location so that three wise men could travel there from wherever? No, not at all. It wasn't a star. It was an actual extraterrestrial spacecraft. And it was shining a light that would guide these three wise men to where the Messiah, the anointed one, would be born. So the three wise men followed the light. So the Immaculate Conception, what is that? Of course, you know, people think it's just myth. It's just Catholics making it up to make Mary out to be, you know, some mythological feature, being born without original sin, who could give birth to Jesus. Well, Mary was actually a very highly evolved being, and her genetics made her suitable for carrying an avatar that could embody the infinite love light energy from the one infinite creator. So she gave birth to Jesus. He was an extraterrestrial hybrid. And somehow he was inseminated into Mary. He carried this pure DNA that enabled him to be a pure conduit of love light energy. Simple as that. He was a son of God, literally, in the sense of like extraterrestrials, genetics being responsible for his birth, but also in terms of him being a conduit for the love light energy. So how do I know? Am I making this up? How do I know Jesus was a conduit for the love light energy? Well, there's a really fascinating book by Dolores Cannon where she did the QHHT therapy on a number of individuals, and they talked about their past lives with Jesus. And they identified Jesus being with the Essenes, that Jesus was taught by the Essenes and Jesus was protected by the Essenes at certain times while he was being hunted by the priests who were frightened of him or the king there. And one of the comments that was made by one of Jesus' teachers among the Essenes, so there was an Essene master who was exclusively tasked to teach Jesus and his cousin, John the Baptist. And one of the things he said, you know, John the Baptist was all fire. He said, this Essene said, John the Baptist was all fire. He was just at it. You know, he would just like, if he thought something was the case, he would just say it and he would do it and he, full conviction. Whereas he said, Jesus, from the very beginning, he was all about the transformative power of love. He just taught love and forgiveness. That was it. Nothing else. None of this thing about being the chosen ones. None of this about exterminating the enemies of the Hebrew nation. None of this of expanding the Hebrew nation so that you could fulfill the word of God or fulfill Yahweh's word to expand. It was all about love and forgiveness. And Jesus's teachings, as they are reflected in the Gospels and different epistles and so forth, mirror the law of one. They have nothing to do with the genocidal policies that appear elsewhere in the Old Testament that are dictated by Yahweh on his subjects, on his devotees. And here's another thing that kind of like really cements the connection between Jesus and the Galactics. Was the Essenes worked directly with the extraterrestrials, with the Confederation of Planets. That's also described in this book. So we do have this theme of Jesus being depicted in terms of UFOs throughout medieval art. So medieval artists understood that there was a profound connection between Jesus and extraterrestrial visitors, or the gods, if you like. And, you know, here's a really famous one. I think it was from Dečani in Kosovo, where you have these two extraterrestrial craft appearing around the time of the crucifixion, and clearly you have spacecraft with beings inside. This was painted during the medieval era. So there was this awareness. So this takes me to Jesus and the Second Coming. A lot of people are convinced that Jesus is coming again. Jesus and the Second Coming. Is it a spiritual event? Are we talking metaphorical? Or are we talking about a real space event? Is Jesus literally going to come on a spacecraft and appear and usher in a new age? So the return of a Messiah or an avatar is a common theme in many religions. So you have the return of Jesus in Christianity, Isa and Islam, Kalki and Hindu, the Hindu faith, the Messiah in Jews, Maitreya, Buddhism, and so forth. So the return of a Messiah, of an avatar, a pure expression of the one infinite creator is pervasive in many traditions. So what makes this very relevant today, this idea of the return of the Messiah, the return of Jesus, whatever your favorite Messiah is that recently there have been a number of sources, independent sources, that talk about the arrival of the extraterrestrial seeders or the guardians. These guardians, or the also called the Intergalactic Confederation. So I did a webinar on this, so I don't want to repeat what's in that webinar. You can go and see it, ET Seeders, Space Arcs, and the Great Reveal. But this, they arrived en masse in the middle of 2021. So they've been here in our solar system for over a year now, the arrival of the Seeders. And I talked about a multinational missions to greet the ET Seeders in an article and also in that webinar. So here's the article. You can find it on my website or can watch the webinar. Earth Alliance mission to Ganymede to greet ET visitors and inaugurate a Star Trek future. So there are a number of sources that talked about this. JP has talked about it. Alex Collier has talked about it. Elena Danan has talked about it. James Gilliland has talked about it. They talk about their extraterrestrial contacts telling them that there were these massive fleets that arrived in our solar system and that the secret space programs learned about this. So in this particular article, I describe how JP, currently serving with the US Army, traveled on a covert mission to Ganymede, which was set up as a major post for the combined space command operations. And they met the Seeders there. And so there's an ongoing delegation or liaisons happening, diplomatic meetings happening on Ganymede, above Jupiter in one of the bases there. So this came out in middle of July. As I said, the first reports were from JP, Elena, Alex, and so forth. Is there any evidence for this? Well, recently the evidence has begun to flow out. It's starting to come. The James Webb Space Telescope began operating in June and immediately started taking some really fascinating pictures and releasing these pictures. So here's one image that shows an area of Jupiter that shows a darkened area just by, So there's the darkened area right there. So that darkened area between Europa and Jupiter, there's a darkened area which is as big as the moon Europa. So this darkened area represents, according to information Elena got from one of her contacts, Una, it represents a very large rock debris field which is combined with the extraterrestrial motherships. So this is where a lot of the motherships are parked, and they're also parked on the other side of Jupiter. But they're starting to reveal themselves because they know very well that the James Webb Space Telescope is focused on Jupiter. And that's very interesting. Why would the James Webb Space Telescope be focusing on Jupiter? I think that's part of the disclosure we're in. There is a disclosure timetable at play here. So more recently, I wrote an article about this very large cylinder or cigar-shaped spacecraft, which could be well over 1,000 miles long, that the James Webb Space Telescope retrieved. And, at the moment, they're releasing low-resolution images of the Webb Space Telescope, so it's very hard to kind of get a clear image of what is being photographed. But nevertheless, they're being released. So it's like there is some effort by the White Hats to release this, to reveal to the world that the cedars, or the creator gods, if you like, have returned and that they're here. There is a program to reveal this. Well, you know, this then raises a very important question. How will the deep state respond to the return of the gods, the cedars? So the deep state, this comprises the human minions of extraterrestrial groups, including the Enlil faction, opposed to humanity's unfettered growth and evolution. So the Draco reptilians, their influence has been mitigated tremendously on Earth, but nevertheless their minions in the deep state are still here. So are they going to try to hijack the return of the gods for their agenda? You bet they're going to try and hijack it. I mean, of course they're going to try to hijack it. So how will they do it? Well, I think I want to present some information to you which will give you an idea of how they may do it. So we're seeing signs that the deep state plans to use religion in a contrived extraterrestrial disclosure narrative. There's already a lot of speculation about NASA consulting with dozens of theologians about the impact of the discovery of extraterrestrial life on religion. This is actually being covered by mainstream media now. So why is NASA doing this? Well, this is the deep state wanting to kind of get ahead of the curve, wanting to get ahead of the story, if you like. The big story that's coming is the extraterrestrial seeders have arrived. They're here. So the deep state, how are they going to get ahead of the story? How are they going to get the New York Times and the Washington Post and the major mainstream media to kind of like spin this to hide the truth and promote their agenda? How are they going to do it? Here's another story, the Daily Mail. We're already starting to see that. NASA looks to the heavens for help. The agency enlisted 24 theologians to assess how the world will react to the discovery of alien life on distant planets and how it might change perception of gods and creation. So already you're getting a narrative, an official narrative being created because NASA, the deep state, are working with theologians to build a narrative and an officially supported narrative about extraterrestrials and the impact on religion. So those like myself who have been on the fringes for over 20 years or so, and people like Alex, been on the fringes for 30 or so, we continue to be on the fringe because when the ET seeders show up, start revealing themselves, they're gonna try and spin all that using their mainstream media sources in the narrative that they're trying to put out now through NASA working with theologians, through the Catholic Church, working with Jesuits, putting out the narrative that extraterrestrials are our brothers and so forth, Gabriel Funes and Guy Consolmagno, they've written books or given interviews about extraterrestrials being consistent with Catholic theology, that all of that is building an alternative narrative so that when the extraterrestrial visitors show up, the deep state can put its narrative out there. And of course, that's going to be very different to the truth of who the seeders are. And very interesting that at this very time, as we speak, on September 6th, here you have a book that's coming out. Jonathan Kahn, he is a best-selling author. His books have done very well, sold millions of copies. And his next book is going to be The Return of the Gods. So he's in this book. I haven't read it yet. It doesn't come out till September 6th, but it's going to put out a narrative that is going to take the return of the gods in a particular direction. And you can bet it's going to be something that the deep state's going to like. So this is what he says. Quote, "Is it possible that behind what is taking place in America and the world lies a mystery that goes back to the gods of the ancient world and that they now have returned?" So he's, as I said, New York Times best-selling book. And to be fair, I haven't read the book, so I shouldn't condemn his book and say that he's going to take it in the direction that the deep state is going to like very much. But I think what this book represents is a coming flood of narratives about what the return of the gods means. And people who put that out you know, whether they're going to spin it in terms of conventional religion or whether they're going to spin it in the direction of the deep state, that's going to be very important. So this is where I want to come back to something that I've discussed in the past. How might religion be co-opted by the deep state for an extraterrestrial disclosure? How might they do it? Well, we've talked about in the past, and there have been many that talked about this since 1995, there was a Canadian researcher by the name of Serge Bonast who put out a book in French about Project Bluebeam. And he was the first person to talk about the use of holographic technology to create these holograms of religious figures to subvert the population and to make them believe that Jesus had come back, that Maitreya had come back, that Isa had returned, that the Messiah had returned. Whatever religion you are, that a region predominates in, that holograms representing that deity will be projected there, and that will be something that will be used for whatever it is the deep state has in mind. So how do you hijack the return of the gods narrative? How do you do that? One way that they can do that, the fleets are here, the extraterrestrial, the Intergalactic Confederation is here, the Guardians are back, their fleets are surrounding Jupiter, some of their craft have arrived around the Earth, people are seeing them, photographing them. So one way that they can do it is that they can depict extraterrestrials as saviors, here to protect us from catastrophic events that are manufactured by the deep state using holograms and other technologies. So in other words, they want to try and co-opt or hijack the return of the gods, and rather than actually have the real extraterrestrial seeders showing up, they somehow contrive events so that they get their groups, their people, to appear to save us from globally manufactured events. So this takes me to something I addressed in a webinar from August of last year, the coming alien false flag psyop. There's a false flag psyop, and in that webinar I discussed the history of this and why I thought the deep state will try to pull it off at some point. So this takes us to the question, right now, is the deep state at a point where it could try to do this? Could it try to finally move forward with this alien false flag psyop? But rather than it being an alien invasion, which is what most people talk about, you know, people like Stephen Greer talk about alien invasion, alien invasion, alien invasion, and that's all they talk about, not really identifying what Serge Bonast described earlier, was that the alien invasion was just one scenario, that within that was also this alien rescue, alien salvation event. So that's what I talk about there. So will the deep state try to do it? Potentially. It's very real, and so we need to keep our eyes and we need to be prepared for that. So in wrapping it up, I thought I would just comment on Elena Danan's new, well, before getting to Elena Danan's new book, I wanted to first talk about some crop circles that were interpreted to represent the return of Enki, the original architect of the human genetics, according to the Sumerian traditions. And in this set of crop circles that appeared in 2002, 2011, 2013, the return of Ea, Enki, a great Sumerian leader who once created all humans on Earth by genetic engineering, he has now revealed himself by name three times in crop circles during 2002, 11, and 13. So I don't want to go into how he revealed his name. There's an URL there at the bottom, cropcircleconnector.com, and you can just go to that website, type in Enki arrival, and it'll come up. So the return of Enki was interpreted in these crop circles. So this takes me to Elena Danan and Enki. And so Elena Danan says she's met Enki twice so far. The first meeting occurred on June 21st on his mothership, and it's named Nibiru. That's an actual mothership, not a planet. And Enki is a title meaning custodian or master of Earth, Chi. And so the conversation she had with Enki appears in her next book. So her next book is going to be called Cedars. That's going to come out sometime in September. Very much looking forward to that. So Enki, Elena, and the Deep State Soil. I've already discussed the Deep State Soil. So Enki chose Elena to be his emissary to deliver his message. And so this is where there's a psyop happening right now. So Enki and Elena met on June 21st this year. Just a few weeks after that, rumors began to emerge that Elena had been murdered, Elena was replaced by a droid, and Enki was evil. Now, one person started talking about that, and that person was given prominence in a lot of platforms across the internet. So now a lot of people are hearing and are believing that Elena Danaan is a droid, the original Elena was murdered, and that Enki is evil. This is a deep state psyop. They don't want you to know that Enki is back and that Enki is working in particular with a particular individual, and that individual is Elena Danaan. So I just wanted to highlight one of the conversations she had with Enki that I think is really very significant to what I've been discussing so far, and it kind of brings the webinar to an end. So the conversation highlights, Ia, Enki, this species of terror has met their destiny. This is the singularity point. This is why we are back. I brought back the Grail, Elena Danaan, the original DNA sequence. Ia, yes indeed, the chalice of the original, unspoiled terror human lineage, the unaltered original genetic sequence. There are more strands in the terror human genome that need to be reactivated, and the original sequence key will do this when transferred onto the altered pattern. So he's talking about the original Adamic man that was created in Eden. That was the fusion of the Anunnaki genetics and the genetics of the primitive human hominids, which in turn was the product of earlier genetic experiments from Guardians, that since those early, that the appearance of Homo sapiens, which is what he's talking about, that the appearance of Homo sapiens, ever since that time, humans have been dumbed down, as described in the Papal Bull, as described in the Tower of Babel. Paul Wallace has described that in his book, Escaping from Eden, that humans are being dumbed down, our genetics are being dumbed down, and that what Enki is bringing back is the original genetic code that was used for Adam. So reactivating the original Adamic DNA, I already gave the frequency key to the High Council of the Galactic Federation of Worlds of Nataru. They are programming it into the new medical technologies that are implemented on Terra as we speak. So this is incredible news. So it means that the genetic tampering that's been conducted on humans by the deep state, by the negative extraterrestrial factions for millennia, that has dumbed down our genetics so that we are a shadow of what our potential is, that is now being overturned by the return of the Cedars, by Enki returning with the original frequency keys of our DNA, and how this can be achieved through different codes, frequencies, light and sound and so forth, and that there are new medical technologies that are going to be released that are going to start helping humanity get activated so that we genetically start to express more of that potential DNA within us, which will impact our environment tremendously to create this Eden around us. So that's incredible information. That's going to come out in Elena's new book in September. I want to thank you for attending and being a part of this. Thank you and aloha.